I'm going to read now from the Old Testament, Exodus chapter 18. If you were telling somebody the account of God's appearing to Moses at the burning bush, going back to Egypt, telling Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, let my people go." Pharaoh saying, "Not a chance." Moses saying, and then you have plague after plague after plague. And then they flee, and they get to the Red Sea, and the Lord parts the waters, and they cross the Red Sea. And then there are unhappy incidents in the wilderness of complaining. And then they get to Mount Sinai. And God appears to them at Mount Sinai, and he gives them the Ten Commandments and the law. I'll bet almost all of us, unless we had the Bible in front of us, would skip chapter 18. Chapter 18 just interrupts the flow of a dramatic story. It's, you might say, an administrative footnote suddenly thrown in there, because in chapter 18 we're going to read about Moses' father-in-law coming, watching Moses do his work as leader of Israel, and his father-in-law says to him, "Moses, what do you think you are doing?" That's really the point of the father-in-law's question. And he says to Moses, "You can't keep it up," and you have a chapter about administration in the Israel and by extension in the church. So that's what we're going to be reading. And it's a very different feel from what we've just read and what we're going to look at in later chapters. Let's pray before we read. Now, Father in heaven, we ask you to take our minds towards what we don't actually naturally pay close attention to, and give us understanding of why this is here in your word and what you mean for us to learn from it. And this we ask in Christ's name. Amen. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." And the name of the other was Eliezer, for he said, "The God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh." And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now he said to Moses, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her." So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that they may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must work, and the work which they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of ten. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times. The hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. Every now and then I get asked, so how did you manage to survive as pastor for 33 years? And I've got several answers, but one big one is I didn't do all the work by any means. I worked with elders, deacons. I love it having deacons. I get a phone call. Can you give money? I'm a poor person. I say, yep, we got deacons. I'll give you the phone number. I get phone calls. We want to sell this and that and the other to the church. I say, great, we got deacons. I'll give you the phone number. And so on. I think a lot of people think all churches are Baptist churches in which you got the pastor runs and does everything. I don't know how the Baptist pastors last, some of them, for as long as they do. We have Sunday school teachers. We have the treasurer who takes care of all kinds of things. We have the Sunday school superintendent, so that mainly I teach and do a little administration. Now, Moses was dealing with a lot bigger group than this small congregation. And they'd been out of Egypt for only a couple of months. And Moses was already on his way to collapse. And Moses couldn't see it, and the people couldn't see it. You needed outside eyes, and it was his father-in-law. His father-in-law came and asked the question. And I think you could probably paraphrase this. Moses, are you out of your mind? Why do you sit here all by yourself, judging these people from morning till night? Morning, he would get up, and there'd be a crowd waiting to talk to him. He'd deal with one after another, barely break for a meal. He'd do it all afternoon, and you'd do it till the sun went down. And Moses was going to just collapse from exhaustion. So that's the question. Why do you sit alone as judge? And Jethro, the father-in-law, asked the question. Now, you may have been a little surprised, I hope you were, as I read, to read these words, and Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law. He said, what's this business, priest of Midian? And then if you go on a little bit later on, you see at the end of the greeting, it's the priest of Midian who offers the sacrifice. And Moses and Aaron and all the elders join in. So, who is this priest of Midian? From earlier in Exodus, the only thing we know is he's a man out in the wilderness with seven daughters, and Moses rescues the seven daughters from the mean shepherds and waters the sheep quickly, and they go home, and the father says, how'd you get home so fast? And they said, well, this Egyptian chased away the other shepherds for us. And the father says, well, bring that man home. And so he comes home and marries one of the daughters and then lives there for 40 years, happy. Now we find he's priest of Midian. Now, if you go combing through your Bibles, which I'm guessing You're unlikely to do this because the details are found in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. If you go hunting through 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and you come to chapter after chapter of 1 Chronicles of genealogy, you come to this that you have only a hint of in the book of Genesis. 1 Chronicles chapter 1 verse 32. Now the sons, genealogies can be interesting. Right. Now the sons born to Keturah, Abraham's concubine, were Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And then it gives the sons of Midian, and it names a bunch more. All right. We think of Abraham as having two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. But he, after Sarah died, married Keturah and had six more sons. And they're named there in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. How many years from Abraham to Jethro? The answer is probably around 600. You can't be sure, but 500, 600 years. That long from Abraham to Jethro. 600 years later, Jethro, descended from Midian, the son of Abraham, is worshiping the true God. He's the priest of Midian. He offers true sacrifice that Moses and Aaron join in with. And this raises several interesting questions. You've got a few other people like this that turn up in the Old Testament. Worshippers of the true God who are not part of Abraham and his family, even further away, you might say, than Midian, or certainly not part of Israel. There's Melchizedek. You may remember the account of Abraham, and he goes to war to rescue his nephew Lot. He is victorious, and on his way back, he meets the priest of Salem, who is also the king, by name Melchizedek, and Abraham gives tithes to Melchizedek. And he's described, called in the Bible simply, the priest of the Most High God. Now, I'm sorry that Angie is not here this morning, but I want to tell a story that will lead into what I want to say about this priest of Midian. Many years ago, when a young man by the name of Mann attended here, some of you who are older will remember him. He was a fellow from Thailand who came to this country after being blinded by his own hand when he experimented with making a bomb. And so he went to Overbrook School for the Blind, and there he ran into believers and was converted, attended church here, went to Westchester University, and then worked for some time in this country until he went back to Thailand. And when we were studying together for his coming baptism, and he was the first person I baptized in the church here 30-some years ago. His final question was this. Am I betraying my ancestors by becoming a Christian? His ancestors were Buddhist. He is Thai. To become a Christian is to betray his ancestors. And I answered this way. I said, the ancestors you're thinking of betrayed you. Because if you trace them back far enough, they descended from people who knew the true God and worshiped him truly. Because they're all descended from Noah and from one of his three sons, Shem, Ham, or Japheth. And so at some point, your distant ancestors worshiped the true God that you have learned about here through Jesus Christ. And that satisfied him. Okay, I'm not betraying my ancestors, not my far most distant ancestors. I'm coming back to where they were. I'm returning to where I've gone astray, or my culture or my nation have gone astray. And of course, that's exactly what Paul says to the Greeks in Athens. He says, You worship somebody and you don't even know who it is. That's why you have an altar here, an idol to the unknown God. I'm going to tell you about the unknown God. And then he basically says, this unknown God created the whole world in the beginning. The whole human race at one point knew him. And then the nations went astray. Some faster, some slower, some more thoroughly, some less thoroughly. The nations went astray and God just let them go astray. Until now. And now he is sending out his word through Jesus Christ and through those he chose and appointed to call them back from where they've gone astray to. Sometimes the Christian church gets reproached in our day by claiming that it alone knows the true way to God. And that reproach is accurate, but not exactly correct, you see. What we're claiming is we're telling the whole world about the one God that their ancestors did know. And then because they didn't want to thank the true God and they didn't want to give glory to the true God, they became foolish and their minds were darkened. And then they began making God over again in their own image. And then they got even more stupid and they made God over in the image of animals. And then they got even more stupid and they made God over in the image of reptiles. And then their whole ethical thinking got all turned all upside down. And finally you end up with Greco-Roman culture. That's what Paul says in Romans chapter 1. But if you follow the ancestors of the Greeks back far enough, you get to Noah. You get to somebody who knows the true God. And the loss of the knowledge of the true God just didn't happen overnight. Some places faster, some places slower. And so here's Jethro, 600 years removed from Abraham. And Jethro, like Melchizedek, is a priest there in the wilderness. God led Moses in the wilderness to actually marry somebody who was a daughter of the priest who worshiped the true God. Not something you'd pick up reading Genesis, but if you put together all these things here in Exodus and First Chronicles, there it is. Now, by the time Jethro comes, he's an old man. If he's had seven daughters by the time he meets Moses, make him at least 30 by that point, 40 years more there. He's at least 70, maybe 80. And did you notice how the Bible gives us a very careful account of Moses' polite and a proper greeting to his father-in-law? So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, who had sent word, "I'm coming," bowed down and kissed him. They asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent where they had a lot further conversation. When we got married, my wife and I, long time ago, the question was in our minds, okay, so what's my relationship now to her father, and what's her relationship now to my mother? And what we said was, the language says how it is supposed to be. Father-in-law means genuine father. Mother-in-law means genuine mother. And the fifth commandment applies. And so that's how we tried to live as well as we could. We failed, I'm sure, in many respects, but that's how we aimed. And that's why in some cases, by the way, American society now has no consistent way of doing this. But in some cases, then the married in children call the in-laws father and mother or dad or something like that. Sometimes they don't. I don't think that's all that important as to what they call them, but it is appropriate. And Moses here clearly views Jethro as father-in-law. I think I'll put it that way. Not father-in-law, but father-in-law. They meet at the mountain of God, Sinai. By the way, nobody's really sure where the biblical Mount Sinai is. You may look at Bible maps and it says, there it is, but the scholars are still not really sure because it's hard to know where some of these place names are in Exodus. So if it's where most Bible maps put it, it's about a 7,500-foot mountain in a whole bunch of mountain ranges. There's one real close by that's 1,000 feet higher, so it's not like Mount Ararat just standing all there by itself, which we may imagine it. Or it may be someplace further north. Moses knew where it was. Jethro knew where it was. And remember, the trip isn't very far. Jethro's coming probably from some other part of the mountain because God said to Moses, you will come back and worship me on this mountain where Moses saw the burning bush. When? Well, they arrived shortly after, really, they got out of Egypt. Chapter 19, verse 1 says 3 months. So 3 months from the time they left Egypt till they get here. What's the reason for the visit? This might surprise you. Jethro is bringing Moses' wife and 2 sons to be with Moses where they should be. You may remember from earlier in Exodus, they went with Moses back to Egypt. And Moses says to his father-in-law at that point, I want them to take to meet the family. That's actually what he says. And apparently after meeting the family, he sent them home. Why? Not to avoid trouble. Moses was headed for trouble. And so the wife and sons were sent back home where they would be safe. Doesn't seem heroic, but it's actually the Bible's view for trouble. If you can flee it, and there's no reason not to, go ahead and flee. When David was running away from Saul, do you remember what he did with his parents? Maybe you don't. Here's what he did with all the rest of his family. He ran away from Saul. As soon as he's able to, he goes, he gets his father and his mother and as many relatives as he can and takes them over to Moab, where his great-grandmother Ruth came from, and says to the king of Moab, will you take and protect my family while I run away from the king? And then David goes back to Israel where he belonged while his family was safe there in Moab. So Moses is doing the same thing. His wife and sons don't go through the plagues. They don't go through the flight. They don't go through all the trouble. But now that they're at Sinai, they come. And Jethro blesses the Lord. Now I know the Lord is greater than all gods, after Moses told him all that God had done there. And then the next day, they've been there one day. They've worshipped God. They've had sacrifice together. They've eaten before the Lord, elders, Aaron, Moses. And the next day, Moses goes back to work, and he gets up early, and the people crowd around him. And I don't know, can you picture the scene? Because I can. They're loud and they're demanding. I'm almost certain they were not queuing up like the English for a bus line. They were like the Greeks that I knew. Here in Athens, at a bus, the Greeks would never stand in line. They would all crowd in a great big, huge crowd right around where the bus was. And I could never get the knack of this. Even when I was the biggest person there, I would somehow always be the last one on the bus and have to stand. These old grandmothers in black were just way better at elbowing their way past me onto the bus. And that's how I picture this here, just a mob. And they're demanding Moses' attention. He gets one and then another. And it would just be exhausting. So Jethro says, what are you doing? And Moses answers, well, the people come to inquire of God, and I settle disputes, and I keep the peace, and I teach them God's law. And Jethro directly rebukes Moses' folly. He says, what are you doing? What you are doing is not good. You will wear yourself out. You're doing too much. You can't do it alone. I like this unsolicited advice. Right? Moses is not saying to his father-in-law, Jethro, how can I handle this situation? Not at all. This is all unsolicited advice. And Moses, who was a humble man, listens to unsolicited advice. How are you with unsolicited advice? All right? Somebody comes to you and says, you need advice, I'm going to give it to you. You know, most people, when they get unsolicited advice, They bristle. I've given my children unsolicited advice. I've given a variety of people unsolicited advice. And every time I do it, I get ready for a hostile reaction. Because most people are just proud and don't, if they don't want it, if I wanted advice, I'd ask for advice. All right? But that's not Moses. Moses actually is a humble person, and he can see the wisdom of what Jethro says. Jethro says to him, "What you are doing is not good. Why are you doing this all by yourself?" And then he gives him advice. You need to find some deputies and put them over a group of 1,000, a group of 100, a group of 50, a group of 10. This is very elementary organization. This is not complicated. This is as simple as it could be. And choose men who fear God. Choose men who are able. Choose men who hate covetousness. Or another translation, I think, maybe better say, hate bribes. I was trying to imagine a TV commercial for this coming fall's election. Vote for Tom Jones for governor of Pennsylvania. He fears God. He hates campaign contributions. And he's really competent. That's what we want in our rulers. We want somebody who fears God so that when he has power and is free to do what he wants in many ways, he will still have a restraint on his behavior. The first principal I worked for, who was, by the way, an excellent administrator, I was sorry when he retired, but his last 4 or 5 years, he had figured out that he was answerable basically to nobody because he was the principal. And so it got more and more the case. You go down and you say, where's Dr. Cox? He's out on the golf course. 10 in the morning, 11 in the morning, after lunch, out on the golf course. He had freedom, and he just took advantage of it. It's easy. It's easy once you get in, on the top and you're answering to nobody to start being irresponsible. And so you want people who fear God and won't take advantage of their power. Second, you want people who are competent. Incompetence. Which do you dislike more in your workplace? Incompetent people or dishonest people? Yeah. I know from my experience, I'm not sure. The people who just can't do their job because they're not up to it can sure ruin an organization. Maybe they're earnest, maybe they fear God, but if they can't do their job, they can make a horrible mess. So that's the second thing. You want people who are able. And third, you want people who hate bribes. Hate bribes. The easiest way in the world to get rich. All right, the easiest way in the whole world to get rich. I don't mean just to have a little savings. I mean to get rich. Is to get government contracts. Or to get government money coming through your hands that you can siphon off to bank accounts in Switzerland and various other havens. And there are loads of political rulers around the world who are rich because they have simply siphoned huge sums of money out of the pockets of the nation they are claiming to serve. It's an ancient, ancient, ancient problem. And when it gets out of hand, it just ruins a country and destroys it. And it's easy. Once you're in power, it is easy. And our courts, even in this country, when you catch such people, tend not to send them to jail. Or if they do, it's not a very unpleasant jail. You want people who hate bribes. Not just won't take them, hate bribes. And there are such people. And they're the ones who really rule well wherever they are. Now, maybe you hear an echo in this whole thing of Acts chapter 6. Do you remember early on in the church's history in Jerusalem, the apostles got busy handling all the finances and taking care of poor people in the church. And they suddenly realized this is out of hand. And they went to the whole congregation and they said, we need to choose 7 men to take this labor from us. And that's where the deacons began from. So finally, Jethro says to Moses, appoint such men, but they have to be the right men. Abel, fear God and hate bribes, and your work will be easier. Appoint the wrong men and the nation will be destroyed. Moses followed Jethro's advice. Chose able men, made them over heads of the people by thousand, by hundred and so on to judge the people, and Jethro went home. I want to end up with just 4 short observations. The first is that, as our confession teaches, the Bible doesn't actually answer all questions. There are some things that even in the church we need to go elsewhere than the Bible for. Here's what the confession says. This is chapter 1, the 6th paragraph. Nevertheless, we acknowledge that there are some circumstances concerning the worship of God and government of the church, common to human actions and societies, which are to be ordered by the light of nature and Christian prudence, according to the general rules of the word, which are always to be observed. In our session recently, we have been going through our book of church government, and the last chapter is rules for running a meeting. And the rules for running a meeting, you just can't get out of the Bible. And we've done this in our congregational meeting. Rules for how you make a motion. Where in the Bible does it say motions have to be seconded? Right, that's not where that comes from. And Jethro is speaking from wisdom that's really common to all of mankind. One man cannot rule a nation of a million and do everything. So he needs deputies. Second observation, outside observers often see things that insiders miss. And that's why in our church we have presbytery visitations every couple of years. Elders from another church come, get to know the congregation briefly, look at it, and often see things that the church itself misses. Third, humble people wisely hear outside advice, even when it is unsolicited and unasked for. In fact, what we need to understand is often the advice that we didn't ask for is coming from the people who care about us and love us the most, because they know they may be asking for a lot of negativity back if they give this advice. Moses knew that Jethro, his father-in-law, had his good at heart, loved the Lord, and meant him good. And Moses was humble enough to listen and follow without argument and without question what was obviously wise advice. And I think we all see it was wise. And last, the question today. Why do you sit alone to judge? Everybody needs help with their work. And people who won't accept or won't look for or ask for help when they need it are foolish people. Moses was behaving foolishly. Jethro told him how to be wise. And we in our work, and people have different reasons. The perfectionists often don't want to ask for help because people who help them won't do it as well as they do. But you have to deal with that. And I can go on with lots of examples like this. But wise people know that we are finite and limited in what we can do, and therefore, when we need help, we wisely accept it and ask for it. Moses did. Why do you sit alone to judge? Jethro asked, And Moses had a rather clear answer, but it wasn't adequate. And so Jethro said, kind of harsh to a guy who's working as hard as Moses was. What you're doing is not good. You're going to wear yourself out, and that will be no good for anybody. If you find yourself working really hard, and somebody comes up and says, why are you doing this all by yourself? Remember, somebody a lot more significant than you was once asked that same question. It was Moses, and Jethro said, why do you sit alone and judge?